And
it had
and
to be. If we were there 12 years, it had to be some kind of a success, you know.
Yeah, what was Connie there that whole period?
In part of it. And the first year, and then after that, the drinking and was just, you know, again the same problem. I was so hopeful that Connie could overcome this problem, and this, he got fired from Nolan Bushnell's place because of drinking, and both Paul and I felt we could. Paul liked Connie a lot. I thought he was a really nice person, but the drinking, hey, that was just too much. And it interfered with our ability to function at the restaurant. And, you know, it ended up Connie had no place to live, and he was living in the restaurant. And we told him, no, you can't live here. You can't sleep on the dining room floor. You know, take a sponge bath. You can't do that.
So what happened?
With the help of a friend of ours who had helped us in the past, this doctor who was a friend of Alan Watts, he loaned Paul and I whatever it was, the amount that we agreed upon with Connie to pay him to end his relationship with us. And so we bought him out. And he went to Mexico and with a girlfriend and blew the money.
Let's run through the trajectory of his life. What happens? Okay, he dies in 1995. How? Let's say he's out of your world in 86, say, 86, 87, in that period, right? So what does he do as far as you know?
Well, he's still living in Marin, and he's somehow, he's working in another couple of other restaurants, and he's running around with a bunch of ex-bikers and crazy people. Somehow he makes a living, you know, puts it together enough to make a living. And eventually Jim Smith comes to town and says, look, Connie, I'll take you to Thailand and on a trip. And Jim was thinking maybe by getting him away from all these people in Marin, he'll get him out, new country. Maybe he'll clean up his act and lick this problem of drinking. Because Jim knew Connie for years. Jim met us when we had the Center of Integration, and Connie was one of the members, and knew David Worcester and so forth. So Jim took Connie to Thailand and introduced him to a lot of possibilities. And Connie came back from Thailand and said, yeah, I think I should go back there and live. And Connie had an insurance policy that was due. It was matured. And he said, I'll get that money. That's $10,000. That'll give me a stake in Thailand. That'll be a lot of money in Thailand, $10,000. We said, yeah, great. Okay. That's what you do. You get the cash, get the money, put it in the, you know, traveler's checks, and go to Thailand and put the money in a bank in Thailand, earn the interest, and get a job or do something, or just do nothing, just live there quietly and get your act together. Well, Connie found out that Margot Johnson, his ex-girlfriend, had changed the beneficiary on the policy, and she got the money. She was very conniving, very clever.
Mm-hmm.
Because Connie, in some drunken stupor, probably told her, "Oh, I'm going to give you the money, dear, when it comes." But she changed the policy. She called up and committed a felony, and Connie said, oh, Jesus, I won't be able to get the money. And we said, no, Connie, you got to get that money from her. You got to tell her that if she doesn't give you the money, that you will go to the police and file a complaint against her. And he said, oh, I can't do that. And we said, okay, forget it. or do it. And we convinced him to go to Palo Alto, where she was living, and threaten her that he will do this unless she gives him the money. Well, he did, and she gave him the money. He came back. He had $10,000 in cash, and he gave it to me. He said, "Here, you take care of it until I can, you know, get my wits straight," and so forth. And so we got him to put the money into traveler's checks and pay off a couple of debts he had, and buy a plane ticket, get a visa, and fly it back to Bangkok, which he did. And he ended up meeting an Australian friend who was opening a restaurant in Nam Kai, which is a northern city in Thailand, and Connie would be his partner. And that didn't work out. Connie was drinking. The guy got the picture pretty clear. Paid Connie off, told him to get out, sorry. And Connie ended up living in a guest house and spending his money slowly. And it dribbled away through the next few years. And Connie was kept in contact with Paul and I. And when he was running low on money, Paul and I would send him some money. And then we got a letter that he was in the hospital, and he needed some money. So Andy and Elaine and Paul and I would send him money each month. It wasn't much, but it was enough to help him get through and to take care of his hospital bill. And he was getting his Social Security, which was $500 or $600 a month, which was seeing him through the bad times he was having. Then Paul and I went to Switzerland to be with Yuji in 95 after being in India. We had sold the restaurant, and just keeping in contact very vaguely with Connie. And then I got a phone call from the embassy in Thailand that Connie had died. So that ended that relationship and so forth. Years of knowing him, seeing a very dear friend go down the tube, you know, as it were. Yeah.
So that'd be 40, 55 to 95, 40 years.
Yeah.
Didn't you have it in your book, you write about Yuji had some response to Connie dying. He didn't say much or something? What was it you said when you told Yuji? If I remember, he was quite detached about it.
He was very detached, you know, utterly detached. No emotion whatsoever. Connie died.
Did that affect, in the moment, that probably affected you?
Yeah, I wasn't looking for any sympathy from Yuji because I knew it wasn't there.
Right.
He didn't care a tinker's damn about anything.
But still, it was a shock when he reacted that way.
To me, yeah, a little bit.
Yeah.
Mahesh was a little bit shocked. So Paul and I went outside. And we walked around to the front of the chalet. And we stood under a tree, and we hugged each other, and both a few tears welled up in our eyes, and we said Connie was a sweet guy in spite of the fact that he was all fucked up with alcohol, and we loved him dearly. And now it's over. Bye-bye, Connie. And we cried a little bit, and that was over.
Yeah. And I was the person who told Worcester he died.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah, 10 years later, I found you on the internet, you know, 2004, 2005, and the little account, you had written something explaining that he had died, and Connie had died in 95, so I told Dave that.
Yeah.
And I met Connie in 69 that one evening. I don't remember him. I remember him just being, you know, quiet. It was more you and Dave talking.
Yeah.
And I guess Dave...
I don't know whether, you know, alcohol is a problem, and it's a poison, and it's an escape from this world. And Connie just couldn't function in this world anymore. It was too much for him, you know. He just wanted to get out, you know.
Well, did Yuji accept people's neurotic response to life like
mm-hmm.
that?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
That was Connie's expression. That was the way Connie lived his life.
Yeah, Connie, you just said he's a goner.
Yeah, but when he met him, right?
Yeah, a goner.
Did he say, what, did Connie would have met him in 66. Did he say it that early?
Right. Yeah, he met him, yeah. No. He did, not then, because Connie wasn't drinking then, you know. Connie.
Oh, but he would have met Connie in the 80s in California, in the scene there around Marvin Gardens. That's when he would have seen.
Connie came to visit him in Mill Valley, and then he invited Eugene and Valentine to come to Nolan's house and have lunch one day. And we all went down there and had lunch together. Connie made lasagna, a vegetarian, 100% pure vegetarian lasagna, which was very good. We had nice lunch in the dining room and lived like we were in a multi-millionaire's house, and you know, but that was part of Connie's fantasy, you know.
Yeah, and Margot was his girlfriend at that point.
Yeah,
at Bushnell's.
She was a friend of Cindy. They were friends.
That's how Connie met her. Yeah, through
Margot,
Cindy.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's, did they get married?
No.
Okay, so while you're drifting through the 80s and engaged in your restaurant, did you go to movies? Did you listen to music? Did you follow events in the media, the Reagan era and then the Bush era? What do you say about that in your life? It had no effect, or you're not interested?
No, you know, we lived in Marin County. We were part of the Marin County scene. Most of our friends were people that knew UG, and UG was continued to come to Marin until 95, and that was the last. Yeah, I think it was about the last of his trips there. Oh no! Pardon me. He did come after that for a few years, but he stayed in hotels at that time, and. And at that time, Paul and I were loose. We were just traveling also. We hadn't got the City Cafe yet, our restaurant, or coffee house. It was a coffee house.
Well, and, what was that? What was the city? That was when, before 2000?
After Connie died and we returned to Marin County, we decided that, I think for over a year we just drifted around and was wondering what to do, and realized that we couldn't just live on the money that we had from Marvin Gardens. It wouldn't last, that, you know, if we spent it. So we should invest it. And so we thought about doing something lighter, you know, not a restaurant anymore. So we thought coffee houses were set, Starbucks was in the wind, and so we said, "Well, why don't we open up a coffee house?" So we went to San Francisco and we looked all around for space, thinking that San Francisco would be better for a coffee house. We couldn't find anything that we thought that clicked, and we went to see a broker who sold businesses, and to ask the broker if he had any coffee houses on the market. And he said no, he didn't have any. He had some restaurants and he was talking about them when the phone rang. And he talked to somebody on the phone for about 5-10 minutes. He said, "Okay, thank you." And he said, hung up and said, "Look, boys," he said, "I just found out there's a guy who wants to sell his coffee house in San Rafael. He just was on the phone. He said, do you want to go take a look at it?" We said, sure. So we went to look at it, and it was right downtown San Rafael on the main street, and it had everything there, everything that we wanted. It had the nice espresso machine. Everything was there. So we went back and said, yeah, we like it. Why don't we set up a meeting? And the guy said, okay. He said, let me make some arrangements. And so he called back and made an arrangement with the owner to list it, you know. So we met the owner, And after a few, meetings, the owner agreed to sell it to us on the grounds that we had experience in restaurant business and we wouldn't be flakes, you know, and he wouldn't get it back. He was worried about getting it back. All restaurant people that sell are worried about that. And so we made a deal with him, a very sweet deal, where we didn't have to put a lot of money down, just a certain amount, and we could make payments to him monthly. Or even though we had the money to buy the restaurant from him, we wanted just to pay him and have a backlog of money to work with, because you need that. So anyway, so we bought the restaurant, and a year after we bought it, we had paid for it, and it was clear, and by making these payments. And so we kept that for 7 years, but we also found out that it was just as much of a problem to run as a restaurant. You have the same problems, staff, and to make it more soluble, to make more money, we added a lunch menu to the restaurant, and we hired back two of the boys that used to work for us at Marvin Gardens to do the lunch. I didn't want to do any cooking, or all I did was plan the menu and design the kitchen that we had. And we got the health department let us do what we wanted to do. At that time, they were very relaxed, and so we did all that. And with a minimal amount of money, we opened a lunch and started increasing the amount of money we're making each day. But we were open from 6 in the morning till 4 in the afternoon. And so that was fairly good hours. We didn't try. Night business was not happening in that part of San Rafael. And we didn't see any point to stay open at night. We were making enough with the breakfast and lunch to exist. We didn't want to really work too hard. Paul didn't want to work too hard. So then I started traveling after that. Yuji invited me to come to Switzerland and explore.
Isn't that 7 years, 95, 96 to 2002. Aren't you in India in 2000 starting to work on your book?
Yeah, I was in India prior to that. I started coming to India I started working on the book in 98 or 9, something like that. And he arranged with Mahesh Bhatt to find me a flat to live in. And I stayed in Versova, which is a suburb in Andheri of the city of Mumbai. And I had a very big flat. Didn't we talk about all that? Yeah, we did. And
But what happened is that Yuji demanded you to write a book in a way. He challenged you to, right?
He ordered me.
he ordered you.
Yeah, and you should write a book. He had a very sweet way. Bob, you should write a book about your life. And he pushed me into doing it, yeah.
And he was right that a record of your life should be put down because of what you'd been involved in and touched in. It was an interesting story, at least for some people, you know.
It would also be my take on Yuji, too, you know.
Right. While you were writing, you'd go over there occasionally to India and write, Paul would be running the cafe, the city cafe?
Yeah. Eventually, I didn't have anything to do with it, so I would just help in planning something. But I would go in the morning, drop Paul off, and drive back to San Rafael, where we were living, and you'd do whatever I was doing, you know.
Yeah, and you were 70 at that point.
Yeah, I was sort of retiring, you know.
Yeah. 70 years old. So when you were in India writing your book, would you talk to Paul on the phone?
A few times, yeah. I had a computer, but I wasn't online, but I had a cell phone, and I could talk. We called a few times. We kept in touch.
Right. Yeah. And he didn't need your advice, really, for the restaurant. He could handle it.
No, he was running it by himself. So,
now, was he acquiring any other lovers while you weren't there?
No.
No?
No, he's had some friends, like Leslie, and who was a friend of Julie, who was an ex-member of Andrew Cohen's cult. And
Leslie was a woman?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you know, he had a he had friends there, you know. But running a restaurant, running a coffee house, and when you get home, you're tired, and you know. And Michael was there, and this lawyer who was a ex Andrew Cohen devotee, where it was a friend, Annie and Elaine, the video people, and.
The video people, the people who took video of UG, you mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
So you would UG ever be in California when you weren't there in this period?
No.
You were usually there when he came.
Yeah, he stopped. Altogether, he stopped coming. Before I went, after I went to India, he stopped. He stopped coming shortly after that. I think there was a few times in Palm Springs he came because he was helping Lisa get her life together, get it organized. She was an ex-Rajneesi and really screwed up and didn't know how to function properly. And he really helped her, put her on the right track, got her going. Now she has two spas since she's operating in Palm Springs, one in Las Vegas and one in Palm Springs.
Right, but you said that he didn't come. That was the last reason he came, was to help her? Is that what you were saying?
He was winding down his California connection.
And Lisa was the last person he was involved in?
Yeah, there were a couple of other people there that some ex-Rajneesis that were staying in Palm Springs that met UG, a German and an American who were married, and they met in the Rajneesh cult and later married. He worked for Intel. He was a lawyer, but had given up being a lawyer.
This period, he was a lawyer in the computer business, is what you're saying. So you would say that you went to India and started writing in 98? I think that's about it.
Yeah.
And UG didn't come to America after that period, once you were going to India.
He came. He continued,
But you'd be there. What year was the last time that he came to India, to California?
I'm not sure.
After you started really writing the book in 2000? 2001?
After that. He was still coming for several years. And I came back, you know, and I saw him in Palm Springs. And
he still was powerful. He still was powerful on people.
Oh, yeah.
On you. Yeah. Never stopped.
He shifted whatever he was doing with Paul and me, more or less. Got us separated, you know. I was traveling and going here and there. And he wanted Paul to be on his own. It was important for Paul to have his own life, his own, and not depend on anyone else.
Does that include him working on the restaurant? Is that him doing it by himself?
He still was had the coffee house.
Right, but is UG saying Paul is doing his own thing at the restaurant once you're not involved anymore? Is that considered Paul on his own?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So that was a personal motive for getting you to write the book, was to get you away from Paul.
Yeah. Yeah.
break that
tie.
Yeah, the codependency.
Right.
Now, were you reading any novels? Going to any movies or theater or anything in the 90s in this period? What's your cultural life?
Yeah, movies and music. Occasionally Indian music. Zakir Hussain would go to concert if it was playing in Moran. And Annie Lane, we visit with them, and Clark Higgins, who was a member of the Retina Circus, and now well, he was working now for Lucasfilm, and a good friend, and just a, you know, quiet Marin life, you know.
Yeah.
So.
Now, did you ever? Go ahead. You were still.
Go ahead.
We're still
taking. When UG was in Palm Springs, we'd go to Palm Springs to see him, you know,
yeah,
hang out.
So, would you ever think of David Wurster in this 90s period? Did he ever?
No,
I don't think he. You didn't
no.
think of him? You thought he might have even died?
No, I knew that he would have been, was trying to make a movie in Hollywood at one time, and I lost track of him completely, though.
Yeah, that's the 70s, early 80s. So by 10, 15 years later, late 90s, you didn't know what had happened to him.
No.
And he was not in your thoughts in any way as someone you'd like to see again.
I don't recall, no. So
not urgent. I mean, was there
I didn't have any interest in any kind of, you know, people interested in, that were involved in any kind of cults or, you know,
spiritual
that kind of
stuff.
Thing. Spiritual
right.
pursuits, yeah.
Was there anybody from, I mean, Dave Wurster must be the only person from the Center of Integration still alive that you knew?
Well, no, there's a couple of other people that are younger than David and I. They're around. Millette's son. And Mary, probably. And there was another son of another family that used to come. A guy whose name was also David, Dave. And, yeah, that's about all, I think. I mean, there might be, but I don't know.
Well, did you know that Phyllis passed on? We know that.
Yeah, Phyllis died,
Did you know about it when it happened?
I might have, I probably, the Patricelli's children and I are still alive.
And who's that, Petrocelli?
They were members. Edith was a close member of the center and a very good friend.
Yeah, Puharich dies in 95, same time as Connie. Leary dies in 96.
And Hubbard died in... Hubbard...
Died in 79, I think. I think he died
79.
In 79. Yeah, somewhere like that.
See, I lost track with Hubbard completely. I didn't know where he was, and didn't know he was living alone.
Well, all those movements and small groupusculos, all those little things that you touched on 50, 40, 30 years ago, are they long gone? Have I drawn it all back, that stuff that you hadn't thought about in a long time?
Well, occasionally, occasionally I have some reminisce about the past. I'm wondering if some people I knew in Portland are still alive or not, and one of my friends, whether he's alive or dead, I don't know. So, people are getting up there. People are getting up there, 81 years old. You know, so I'm not sure. You know. I don't think about it. You know, here in India, it's all my friends are like under 30 years old. I have a few friends that are in their 50s, like Mahesh and Arun Babani and his wife, who he's a writer and a good friend I go and see every week. He was a Rajneesi, and then he met Yuji, and all that ended, you know. The rest of the people are film people. They're directors and actors and media people of some kind, like that.
And, right, I just looked
they're
up.
All young. They're all young. They're all young people, 27, 25 years old.
Okay, I just looked up Al Hubbard. He died in 82.
82, yeah.
Yeah, and he would be 81 years old.
Yeah.
What was I going to say? We're talking about. Bringing writing your book made you think of all these things. So I'm saying,
all that up. Uh-huh.
Yeah. So let's say in the early 90s, when you're running Marvin Gardens, and then you're over in Europe, then you come back into City Cafe. Before you start doing the book, are you thinking of these people? Worcester, is your past, you're so involved.
No, I don't, person? I just the present.
Unless
somebody asks me. I don't think of the past unless somebody asks me about it, and then it comes up. But otherwise, it's there in the background, but I'm not reminiscing about it at all.
Right, you
even
live
my
in the
sister.
Present.
When I write to my sister, or she writes to me, she lives on the East Coast. It's all current information. You know, current what's happening. So
right.
Forth.
So that you lived in the present. Basically, you were living in the present all this that period. You know, it was an active life, and you felt. Did you feel that were you bored with your life? Did you feel tuned in? Did you feel that you were as aware as possible of what you were doing to the degree you got some techniques of awareness? Did you hear that?
Yeah.
Do you think any of that awareness stuff helped you as you got into your 70s?
Well, I mean, JK, I tried to be aware. Try to be choicelessly aware, you know.
Quoting J.K.
Yeah.
Quoting J.K.
Yeah, choicelessly aware, and so I had I assumed that I was, you know, I could be aware, you know, and I was aware, of course, but after hanging out with Eugene, and at some point, the idea of being in any particular state. Is not what I'm trying to achieve or be. There isn't any state to be in other than the state of Mahashastra in India or Marin County as a state.
Yeah.
Or Hawaii as a state. That has burned out of me, that idea that there's some place to be other than where I am. Where I am is just fine. That's it.
Could you stay in this state or this that's it level for another 200 years?
I don't.
God forbid. Oh, okay. So you won't mind dying.
Yeah. No. No, it has to come to an end. I think I told you this. I was videotaping Yuji one day in Switzerland, and I was looking in the viewfinder, in the eyepiece, I think, of the camera, and he was talking, and as he was talking, I had this sudden experiencing that what he was saying, I had a sense of grasping it. I understood it. And what he was saying is, that he never is in any state of consciousness more than a millisecond. It's changing every moment. So whatever is now, it's changing. It's constantly. And he's not landing and being caught up in any state. And just for, I don't know, whatever happened, I saw that. I experienced it. And it was frightening. Because you're not there anymore. That can't, what you are can't capture it. It's an unknown, you know. Every moment
right,
is
so,
an unknown.
So I don't know if death. I don't know if death is frightening to you, but it was an inkling of death. Because you were alive, you felt fearful about it, or. Your adrenaline went up, but the impact of his speech got it to you. You were ready to get it.
Yeah, whatever that was. I think it was 1995 that happened, something like that.
Yeah.
Anyway, so today, you know, India's interesting is that it's not lineal. Like, plans don't necessarily occur. You may plan to do something and then get side railed, you know. And so you go, if you're stuck on the idea that I have to be there, you know, there's a problem. But suddenly you're shifted and, I'm not going, you know. Mm. And I used to watch my cat. I had a cat named Hanuman. And I used to watch him, and he'd be walking along, and suddenly, he'd decide to move, go someplace else. Or he'd be sleeping, and suddenly, he'd be get up, you know, and I used to think, he's got to go someplace. And he'd scurry out, you know. And then all of a sudden, he'd be back, you know. And that's how the animals live. They live spontaneous, you know.
Yeah.
And so my life is far more spontaneous now. That yesterday someone asked me, are you going to Andiri tomorrow? I said, maybe. I don't know. And then I got your email, and it said, we have a meeting today.
Right.
I said, that's right. And so now any plan to go to Andiri at 11 o'clock is off. I'm going to do the meeting with Bob and Scott. And so now after lunch is over, I don't know what's going to happen. I know that I'm going to go buy some strawberries because India has wonderful strawberries that are grown without chemicals. They come from Malabarshwar, which is a hill station near Bombay, and they're delicious. They taste like the strawberries you used to eat when you were a kid, you know. Mm. Not these pumped up hyper strawberries you buy now.
unless
you buy them at a farmer's market where they're grown naturally, you know. So anyway, I'm going to go buy some strawberries and have a coffee at a little place called Coffee Day, which is an espresso bar, coffee house, and I can sit there and have a coffee and a brownie and sit there for an hour and enjoy the, you know, that, and then probably come back, and I don't know what I'll do in the afternoon.
What about calling the person who called you? Call them back.
Yeah, I have to call them. That's a Time Out magazine. Do you have that in Hawaii?
Yes. Yeah.
It's everywhere.
Yes.
They have it in India, and they have a pair of sunglasses that I won, so I have to go pick up. And Kunal went to the bank to open up an account so that when he goes to Thailand, he has a good bank account that he can impress the Thai people with. So they went to do that. And Jim Smith, my friend from years ago from the center, who's in Victoria right now, Jim is meeting us in Thailand in Nam Kai. Oh, no, I'm in Chiang Mai. And I just got an email from my friend Sebastian that he's meeting Kunal and I at the airport. And
he's in Victoria, British Columbia, you mean?
No, Jim is in Victoria right now, and he's flying to Thailand. And it'll be
Victoria, British Columbia? British Columbia. That's where Jim lives.
Yeah.
Is he Canadian?
No, yeah, right. And we chat all the time on the back and forth, Skype, or we chat on the Google Talk, you know.
Well, he's someone from the Integration Center of Integration Day still alive.
Yeah, he's 70 years old.
He's 10 years younger than you.
Yeah.
He's a Canadian?
He's American and Canadian both.
Okay.
He has a Canadian passport, he's born in America. You know.
Right.
He's Canadian. He likes to have two passports.
Okay, so the... So while you go to the cafe, we're going to end in a second. You're going to go to the cafe. You'll think a little bit about what we talked about and wonder why we did it or what was interesting. You'll think about that. Let's see. Was there something else? So that's coming up. I got a few more questions, and we'll do another session tomorrow if you can make it.
Yeah, well, eventually I moved to India on my own. Paul and I decide to separate. And he's made some friends in San Rafael that are urging him to separate, you know. And everybody wants to tell everybody else how to live. Then live their own life, you know.
Right, you mean these friends in San Rafael, addition to Yuji, were telling him to remove from you.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's 7 or 8 years ago.
Yeah. And so we decide to, and we sell the restaurant. It was such a trauma to sell it. We sold it to a Thai lady, and it was really a traumatic experience selling it. The health department has changed in a few years that we had had the restaurant and had all kinds of new rules. And about when you sell something, everything has to be up to code, and the new codes come into play. And the new codes come every year, so you're stuck with having to appease them. You have to make a deal. You'll do so much, you know. It's all bargaining, and we bargained with them to, you know, made them feel guilty. But we finally were able to sell the restaurant and realize some money, and I put the money in a bank, and Paul put the money in the bank, and I came to India, and Paul went to Switzerland and hung out with Yuji for 4 years while I was staying in India. And my first 6 months, I was staying in Raj's house in Colaba with his sister, Sashi. And then after a while, I decided that I needed my own place because I wanted freedom, you know, to come and go and have friends and so forth. And so my dream of being an Indian, which was behind it all, was happening. I was vicariously being an Indian. I always wanted to be an Indian. I never copped to it really truly, but I got fascinated by India when I was in my 20s, and I wanted to be like an Indian. I wanted to be Indian. I'd study the philosophy and yeah.
Okay, so you're saying that started in before the book was published in 2003. You started to feel you were an Indian.
Oh, I wanted to be an Indian back in Portland.
Oh, I know, but when? Yeah, but you're saying that finally you had your own place.
Yeah.
That's when you're working on the book.
Yeah, yeah, in Versova. And I was having, you know, it was fun being on my own. I could get around, and I had some Indian friends. Some of them were in like Raj, who and his sister were in Colaba, and then I had a few friends that I met in Versova. I met a very nice girl that lived in the same building, and we became Deepa, and we became friends, and friends with her mother and father and brother. And Mahesh and his friends, Tanuja Chandra, a director, and
Where is this place? Is this near Bombay or Mumbai? What you're talking
it's in
about?
Mumbai. It's in Mumbai. It's in the suburbs.
But it's not where you are now.
No, I'm further out now than that.
Okay.
I'm in Thakur Village, which is only 5-6 years old. The area. Before that, it was a mangrove. It was jungle. Yeah, I can see the hills from where I am, and the hills there are all trees, and there are animals living there. There's even some tigers and monkeys and bears and living there. Yeah, yesterday or a couple of days ago, I was in an auto, and we were going to Andiri, and suddenly there I looked at the auto, and there was an elephant walking down the street. It hit me. Wow, an elephant walking down the street. I'm in India. This can only happen in India. Well, wouldn't it be in California? You know?
Oh, and
I laughed
and this,
at myself.
No,
right in the heart of a busy street, you know.
Right where you are.
Yeah, it's 20 minutes from where I am. Mm. So a busy, busy, busy street.
Wow.
An elephant is down the street.
And what is it doing? Who's, is it a wild elephant?
A guy, There's a guy. No, it's a guy driving it, you know, riding it. Yeah, he's taking it someplace. I don't know. A lot of elephants, they beg on the street. They give them money, and they pick the money up with their trunk and give it to the mahout who's sitting on top. And in Thailand, it's happening too. At night, you see elephants walking on the main streets. It's sad in a way, you know. It's very sad.
Why is that sad?
Because they have no place anymore in the culture anymore. They're not part of, you know, used. And they've been trained, and they're, you know, 30, 40 years old, whatever they are, and they have no place to go, and so the mahouts can't use them in the jungles, and so they're in the cities, and it's the wrong place to be. A city? Traffic? Elephants? You know, Jesus.
And there's nobody riding them. They wander around alone.
Oh, yeah, no, there's the guy riding them, guiding them. Oh, they don't wander by them. Pardon me, by themselves. I was just talking to a friend of mine, Harshad, who stayed with me for a while. He's a film a director and filmmaker. He just got back from Kerala. He was in the jungle. They're shooting a film there with two top stars in Indian cinema. And he said that they see wild elephants there in the jungle. And, of course, they are quiet when they see them because they're wild, you know, so forth. So it's, you know, India still has that jungle, you know, areas where there are elephants, tigers. And he says he sees snakes all the time. Every day they see snakes, you know.
Right.
Some are poisonous, some are not poisonous, you know. They learn. But he's staying in a deep in the jungle in Kerala. And Kerala is still wild. And it's still old India. When you go there, you go back in time to how it, you know, used to be. Yeah. You know.
How many miles are you from the terrorist Taj Mahal hotel, where the terrorist incident happened?
An hour away by train.
Oh, you're quite far from that area.
Yeah.
But that's all where you are, and where it is, an hour train away, is all within Bombay.
Yeah, Bombay is quite large now. It's spread out. It was a series of islands, and the British filled them in and made a city. And the Indians have continued to fill it in, you know, making more land, because it's growing all the time. People are coming to Bombay every day. I don't know how many thousand people come every day. It's incredible. Millions of people ride the trains every day, the commute trains. It's just a bustling city. It has a life. It's like New York. It has an energy.
Yeah. Okay, Robert. We will resume tomorrow, same time, 11 o'clock in the morning for you.
Okay, fine.
So thank you very much, and I have some more things I want to bring up. I don't know where it's going to lead, but we got another session to go anyways.
Okay, all right, fine.
Okay. Thank you very much. Bye.